Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When my children were little, there was nothing I liked more than having them nestled in my lap or curled up beside me with a book. I'd expected to love the intimacy of those read-aloud moments, but I couldn't have predicted how much I would enjoy the stories themselves. Some of them weren't just good as kids' books go, they were good books, period. Bruce Handy agrees with that, and although he found that not everything that delights children holds up under adult scrutiny, he believes great children's literature deserves a place among the best books written for adult audiences. Bruce Handy is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York City to talk about it. Bruce, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
People have written for children for a long time, but it's a relatively recent development that anybody has tried to entertain them as opposed to just writing them a sermon.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at some of the very earliest children's books, including what is believed to be the first children's book published in America, the New England Primer. Yeah, this is in the 17th century, and it's just, it's very grim, it's very instructional. I mean, they literally have, it's sort of like catechism for kids. It's, be not a dunce, do not play with evil boys, things like that. I mean, it's not even literature. It's just, it's literal instruction. I think it's really, as I understand it, it's really not until maybe the mid-19th century where you really do start, as you say, having books that are meant to entertain children, kind of one of the first and most important being Little Women, which, was kind of revolutionary in its time.
You didn't read Little Women as a boy. You read it later, and we'll talk about the reasons for that in a while. But you didn't really care for it that much, and you discovered that Louisa May Alcott didn't care for it that much. She said she wrote it because she needed the money.
Yeah, well, she had been writing all these kind of gothic potboilers, and her there was right after the Civil War, there was kind of a boom in children's publishing. I think it was Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates was published right after the war and was a huge hit, and also the first I forget what the first Horatio Alger title was, but that also came out at that time. So yeah, publishers were suddenly, ooh, there's this whole market of children's books. We didn't realize this before. So her publisher called her up and asked her to write this book, but yeah, she was very. She was very reluctant. She just kind of thought it was silly. I think, there's a letter where she talks about, well, I'm, sort of basing it on the sort of queer pursuits of my sisters and I, and maybe somebody will find it amusing. I think she was kind of very taken aback when it was a huge best. It was an instant bestseller. What we know of as Little Women was actually her first book and then its sequel. Which are now sort of combined, and then she went on to write two more sequels. But yeah, and I think she kind of always resented it, and then she actually became very famous, and people would actually hound her and knock on her door and expect her to be Jo March and be disappointed with her. So she found that kind of a burden in life.
You did discover that you liked the Little House books.
Oh, I love them. Yes, that was another. I wrote a. It's a little bit sadly sexist on my part, but I did write a chapter on what I call "quote unquote" girl books, which were books that I never read as a boy, and most men and most boys that I know of don't read. I'm 58, so hopefully maybe younger generations are less kind of gender segregated than I was. But I found. I enjoyed Little Women. I mean, Jo March is an amazing character. There's a lot of sort of moralizing going on in that book that didn't appeal to me. And I had a kind of a tough time with Beth. But yeah, the Little House books, I thought were amazing. I was only, for my purposes of writing this book, I was only planning to read, the first two or three. And then I sort of fell in love with them. And I just sort of tore through the whole series. It's nine books, I think, altogether, including a sort of funny posthumous one. There's all kinds of great adventure stuff. I mean, in some way, boys should really read these books. I mean, if again, we're going to be sort of, kind of you know, go into gender stereotypes, but there's all kinds of, you know, hunting and skinning animals and smoking venison and, you know, dealing with snow, you know, blizzards. And I mean, there's a lot of adventure in those books. But also the other thing that I found that I was just so very compelled by the character of Laura Ingalls. It's interesting. She writes the books. They're essentially novelized memoirs, but she writes them in the third person and, you know, refers to herself as Laura, and she's a great character, and she's adventurous. She always wants to try, you know, everything. There's a great line in one of the later books where they're sort of living in town, and Pa warns her and her little sister to kind of stay away from the railroad because there's some men working, and he says, you know, they might hear some rough language, and there's a great line where it said, you know, Laura knew she should obey Pa, but she was actually very interested to hear some rough language and find out about that. So how can you not love a character like that?
Going back to read those books with my kids, which I have to say I loved as a girl and read and read and read, there was so much that I realized went right over my head. You know, those scenes where Pa's crops have failed again and he's like exhausted and depressed. I just read those straight the first time. And now every time I think about them, I find them really moving as an adult, like what the adult Ma and Pa had to face trying to keep these little kids alive in a very inhospitable place.
Oh, well, yeah, and I know, and there's in I think it's I believe it's a Little House on the Prairie where they're building their log cabin, and the log, you know, one of the logs actually falls on Ma's foot and, you know, sprains it or breaks it. I mean, they don't have X-rays, and yeah, she basically just has to kind of grin and bear it, and she kind of binds it up, and she's still, you know, cooking dinner that night, and, you know, and she's, yeah, they're so very stoic. I have older ancestors who were sort of pioneers in Colorado and working in silver mines and things like that. And I remember that very firm reticence really rang really deeply with me.
What do we do with the now really antiquated treatment of Native Americans? I mean, to a certain extent, you can say, well, this is a portrayal of what white settlers felt about their Native neighbors, but it really does, you know, we have these Ingalls characters that we come to love, and they're not very kind at all about their Native neighbors.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's something those books are being increasingly, you know, called out on. I think, you know, I think every reader and every parent has to kind of make up their own minds how to deal with that. I mean, I think the books are very, very much worth reading. But I think, yeah, if you're reading some kids, you should, you know, sort of, you know, caution them or prepare them for this, you know, this aspect of it, and sort of make it clear that this is, you know, that these are historical attitudes. But yeah, they are. They are true. They are absolutely true to their time. You know, unfortunate, but true. And I certainly think kids who are old enough to appreciate the other aspects of those books that we celebrate, I think are certainly old enough to understand, you know, the parts of American history that, you know, they're maybe less happy.
So it's not just novels that you look at here. The first book you write about is Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown. This is the one with the great green room and the red balloon and the telephone. I can't say I love it exactly, but it is, I mean, it's undeniably hypnotic.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny in your intro, which I thought was really lovely. I'm going to like write it all down and start to use it when people ask me to explain my book.
You.
But where you were talking about, you know, you were talking about how reading to your kids and you started to see things in these books. I mean, that was exactly my experience, which led me to write this book, and was certainly, you know, my experience with Goodnight Moon, which is a book I didn't really know. As I said, I'm 58, so I was a kid in the 60s. And Goodnight Moon dates from the late 40s, and it's always been in print, but it didn't really become, you know, now it's sort of ubiquitous, really. But that didn't really happen, I think, until the 80s and 90s, kind of with the introduction of board books. But anyway, so I was kind of, certainly when we had kids, I was aware of Goodnight Moon, but I never really like looked at it or read it. But then as I read it to my kids, and again, each time I started seeing more and more in it. I mean, to me, it really starts with that opening phrase that you just quoted, in the great green room, which I think to me is so beautiful because it really captures, I think, the way a 1 or 2 year old looks at the world, because it's such an interesting way to start the book, in the great green room, because that's what it, you know, great. It's like to a little kid, a bedroom, even just a bedroom, is like a huge, vast, you know, even kind of mysterious place. You know, that when I was reading the book and also, you know, and interacting with my children that young, I had a lot of floods of memories, you know, of my own childhood and just, you know, kind of stray memories of being in a crib and you know, sort of looking out and surveying my room the way the book does. And I think also, you know, little kids are so fascinated with objects and kind of naming things and understanding things and sorting things. And I think that book really speaks to that. So I guess, yeah, partly I found that book very moving just because it seemed to me so, Margaret Wise Brown, the author, had just done such a great job of kind of, you know, empathizing with children and the way a very young child sees the world in kind of a profound way. And then also I think the artistry of it, the illustrations, I think are beautiful, and the way they kind of evolve as you turn the pages, and the way the emphases shifts and the lights sort of slowly fades, and you have that beautiful last page that goes with the words "Goodnight noises everywhere," and the room is kind of dark, all the colors are sort of grayed out except for like the outside the window where there's this sort of bright cerulean blue and you see stars and the moon, and it's just really a lovely visual work of art and a very kind of crude, you know, very sort of formative kind of visual narrative for kids.
We always read that last line in our house in a whisper.
Oh, that's, yeah. Well, that's the other thing that's so fun about these books, because they, you know, you can read them, you know, each parent can kind of find their own emphases and their own rhythms. And yeah, I mean, in our house, you know, we always laughed at, goodnight mush, you know, because nobody, I don't even know. I still don't know what mush, I guess it's like oatmeal or something.
Yeah.
I don't even know. But yeah, I think porridge, I don't know.
Safe to say,
what porridge is.
If somebody gave you a lineup and said, okay, pick out Margaret Wise Brown, the writer of these sort of gentle stories for small children, the actual Margaret Wise Brown would escape every time undetected.
Oh, yeah. No, she was like, yeah, she was totally, she was like this great character. I mean, in real life, I kind of always envisioned her as, you know, the old lady whispering hush. Because,
right.
Yeah, you think she's this kind of grandmotherly figure that you're just going to cuddle up with. But, yeah, she actually physically resembled Carol Lombard, I think, and was kind of actually like a little bit of a sort of madcap, kind of screwball comedy heroine. I mean, she had all kinds of crazy pets. She lived in Greenwich Village, and at one point had a flying squirrel in her house and a goat, and she just spent, she was a very successful, children's book writer. She certainly wasn't like a household name the way she is now, but she made a very good living, and one time she spent the entire advance on a book on a whim on just a cart full of flowers. She bought the whole thing and just, you know, shoved her whole apartment full of flowers. I mean, she had a kind of house that she decorated on a small island in Maine, very whimsically. I mean, she was kind of a real cut up and had very interesting sort of complicated, messy love life, and tragically died very young from a blood clot that was a sort of a complication from appendicitis. But yeah, I mean, the story, I mean, not to make light of anybody's death, but when she died, she'd been in the hospital recovering from appendicitis, and sadly, unbeknownst to her doctor, she had a blood clot. But one of the nurses asked her how she was feeling. She said, "Oh, great!" And she like literally kicked up her heels, and that dislodged the blood clot. And that's what killed her. But certainly, yeah, Margaret Wise Brown kicking up her heels as her last act is kind of as far as last acts for somebody's life goes, it was certainly appropriate for hers.
My guest is Bruce Handy. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAthink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You are now the king, and you will be a truly great king.
Oh, look, it looks good on him. Look. He looks great, our king!
You look perfect.
King.
It looks perfect.
I'm a king.
Fresh king!
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was a cut from the 2009 movie adaptation of Maurice Sendak's classic Where the Wild Things Are. My guest this hour is author of a book called Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. Bruce Handy is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Bruce, I hadn't thought before reading your book about the importance of editors in children's literature, especially for the shorter works like picture books. It turns out that Where the Wild Things Are really benefited from some guidance from an editor.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the editor. Maybe you have that in your notes. But yeah, she was a very important children's book. Ursula Nordstrom. That's who I'm thinking of. Yeah, she edited Sendak. She edited Margaret Wise Brown. A ton of people. Where the Wild Things Are was originally going to be, Where the Wild Horses Are. But she and Sendak both, decided that he wasn't really that good at drawing horses, so it ended up being Where the Wild Things Are, which was obviously a big improvement. It's sort of true too, actually. I mean, I always thought that was, I always wondered if that was like kind of slightly a fanciful story on their part. But I actually saw I saw an earlier Sendak book where there was like not a horse but a pony, and actually the pony, he kind of had a little trouble with the legs. So I think there's a lot of truth in that story, actually.
You didn't love that book as a kid, but you really came around as an adult rereading it. What had changed for you?
Well, I think, when I was a kid, I just thought it was sort of strange, and it just didn't really make sense to me. It didn't reach me. I think I liked fantasy and fairy tales, but I liked them with kind of a logic, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I liked The Wizard of Oz, where it's literally, Dorothy, she gets picked up in a tornado and dropped in Oz. And there's actually, you can look at a map of Oz and you can kind of imagine it bears some relationship to, where we are, or, the same with Narnia. But yeah, it's that dream logic of Where the Wild Things Are, where Max is in his room and all of a sudden trees start growing and suddenly he's in a forest, and then an ocean appears and he crosses it and he's this strange land of the wild things. And yeah, it just seemed odd to me as a kid. But yeah, as an adult, suddenly I saw it, like, oh my God, that's so dream, the dream, that's exactly what appealed mm-hmm. to me. It's like the strangeness and the dream logic of it, I found very compelling. And then I also suddenly saw it as, well, there's this, psychologically tinged kind of pseudo fairy tale. And yeah, and Sendak was a big, he was big into analysis, he was a big Freudian, and yeah, it was this story of Max, this boy who's angry, and it's how he learns to kind of, both sort of conquer his anger and I think also learn that it's okay to be angry. That's how I read the story now, which I find, it's expressing some sort of complicated basic ideas in a very beautiful, poetic way. So yeah, so I loved it as an adult. And the punchline was when I first really read it as an adult, when it was given to me as a baby gift, and I was so excited. Oh, I can't wait till my daughter Zoe is, two or three and old enough for this book, and my son Isaac, who followed shortly thereafter. And then the punchline is when they were old enough, they didn't really like it either. but obviously a lot of kids do love that book, certainly.
This is not a book about illustrations, but Garth Williams comes up over and over, who drew pictures for Charlotte's Web and the Little House series and Bedtime for Francis. Mostly he did pencil drawings. Sometimes they were colored in. What is so magical about his work?
That's a great question. I think it's very much his character, his character work. Like Wilbur the Pig, it's just, those drawings are so expressive. Or also, Frances the Badger, similarly, and her parents. I mean, one of my all-time favorite Garth Williams illustrations is of Frances's father when she's waking him up in the middle of the night and Bedtime for Francis. Yes, exactly. He's got that look on his face, which I'm sure all of us parents have had at some point. But he wrote about how he would draw animals and he would just keep drawing them and drawing them till he finally found the kind of character within that he was looking for. It's almost sort of sounded like his process was maybe, you know, a little bit the way sculptors sometimes talk about. They just have a block of marble and they kind of find the form within. It almost sounds like he would keep drawing pigs till somehow Wilbur's personality somehow started to emerge in the drawings. But that, yeah, it's that quality. And the same with the Little House books, the way he draws the girls and Ma and Pa. They're marvelous.
Bedtime for Francis works for children who can identify with being freaked out by a crack in the ceiling or a bathrobe that looks like a tiger. It also works for parents who just want their kids to go to sleep. On the other hand, there are books like The Giving Tree that Shel Silverstein wrote that I have to tell you, it's one of a very small number of books that people gave my kids as gifts that I just couldn't bear to read. I put them away. But this is one of those really debated books among parents. Remind us of the story of The Giving Tree.
Well, yeah, so it's about this young boy, and he plays with a tree, and the tree is referred to as she or her, and it's sort of like a surrogate or a pseudo mother. And when he's a little boy, the tree gives him shade and apples. And when he gets older, he wants to, he needs some money, so I think the tree lets him saw off some of her branches, and on. Eventually, he's made a mess of his life, and tree lets him cut her all the way down, and he builds a ship to sail away, and then he comes back and he's an old man and he's very tired and he just needs a place to sit. So there's the stump. He sits on the stump, and I'm totally in your camp. I just find that book, so kind of maudlin. And as a parent, I certainly appreciate that it's sort of a rare book for kids, I think, that's really kind of taking the parent's point of view. But yeah, to me, it kind of reminds me of, just these, it's like, puts me in mind of, Sophie Portnoy or something. I think it's just it's so guilt-inducing. And yeah, people love that book. A friend of mine who's, very, very close said he couldn't wait to read my book, and he was so excited because he loved The Giving Tree, and he'd just been reading it to his kids the other night and sobbing. I said, well, you may not like what I have to say about The Giving Tree. But yeah, I think that might be the most sort of divisive of any children's book. It seems like it's really either love it or hate it. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, my feeling is the tree as parent fails because the boy is never grateful. Like, he never realizes how much she's sacrificed. It's just all about him.
Right. It's like, I know, it's exactly. It's like Stella Dallas at the end, sort of looking at the window as the daughter's getting married. I don't know. I think it's unpleasant. I wish it's too bad. Maybe are we having some call-ins? Maybe somebody will call in and explain why they love The Giving Tree,
up the rest of the hour with that. We are going to take a call. This first call is not about that, but let's go on the line and speak with Jay in Dallas. Hi, Jay.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
I read a book. I think it was called The Five Chinese Brothers when I was a kid. Are you familiar with that?
Oh yeah, I remember that. Very well. Yeah.
I really liked it as a child, but then when I was looking for books for my grandchildren, and thought, I'll give them that book, and then it comes across as outright racist, as the stereotypical depiction of Chinese people. So I'm just wondering how that holds up. I don't know if it was written to be that way, or if it just, because it was probably written in the 30s or 40s, if I recall.
I believe it's from the 30s. Yeah, I honestly don't know anything about the author. I mean, I assume it was, I hope it was written with a good heart. But yeah, it certainly reflects ideas about race and culture that seem kind of pretty bad. Sadly backwards today. I mean, there's less glaring examples, but there's some ethnic stereotypes in some of Dr. Seuss's books too. That I think it's like kind of what I was saying about when we were talking about the Little House books. I do think parents have to make their own decisions about these kind of books, and I certainly think if you are going to read them, you can certainly talk. It's a teaching opportunity, but it is, and this is, part of our history, our cultural history, as people. It's reflected in our films. I mean, certainly, you know, God knows there are parts of Gone with the Wind that are hard to sit through too. And children's books reflect that culture every bit as much as film and music and everything else.
There was a time in my life when I had The Cat in the Hat memorized so that I could recite the entire, frankly, way too long book to my son who was sitting in the back seat on a road trip. But the story behind it about the challenge that Theodore Geisel took on to write that is pretty fascinating.
Well, yeah. So, yeah, it was written really directly to be a kind of counterpart to the Dick and Jane, you know, primers, you know, run, Dick, run, see Jane, laugh, et cetera. But yeah, he was given, I believe, a list of 300 words. And yeah, out of that, you know, sort of was able to, after much thrashing and hashing, I think it took him about a year altogether to finally sort of crack it and write it, but he came up with the Cat in the Hat. But I do agree with you. I think it's a little bit too long. Is that part where, you know, I can, you know, where the cat is balancing the rake and the cake and the, you know, the boat and the goat or whatever. And it's, you sort of feel like once you know, I felt once I knew the story behind it, I felt like a little bit, okay, he's just ticking off some words on his on his list here. But
And it feels so transgressive because at the end it suggests that the boy and his sister might lie to their mother about what went on all afternoon.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really fascinating. I mean, in some ways, yeah, I think I say this in the book. It's sort of, you know, in some ways, you know, in the sort of the popular parlor game of when did the 60s start? Did it, you know, start with the assassination of JFK or the, you know, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. But you could say, yeah, it started in 1959 when the Cat in the Hat was sort of asking, you know, children to kind of, you know, keep secrets from their parents, you know, baby boomers. That was literally the book came, 57 was when the book came out, and that was literally the peak year of the baby boom. So it was kind of a, you know, sort of an apt marker, I think.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bruce Handy, who's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book Wild Things: The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Mike in Plano. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for the show, and I think it brings light to something that's kind of a guilty pleasure among adults, which is the reading, you know, children's literature, because it's not only stands on its own, but it also brings back such pleasant bonding memories, you know? But one book I
Absolutely.
Wanted to talk about was Polar Express by Chris Van Allsburg. This was a beautiful book. The story was beautiful. It was illustrated beautifully. It was meant to be read slowly and quietly. And somehow or another, the commercial possibilities of it ruined it. And so now, at the very few parents I think will read this anymore because it's easier to just slip in the DVD or to stream the movie. And what they see is very different from what the book was. It's about chases, it's about action, it's about special effects. And very few people will ever recognize what a lovely piece of work that was, what a lovely piece of art.
What do you think about that, Bruce?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I just thought, you know, as much as I admire Robert Zemeckis and Tom Hanks, I thought that movie was disastrous. I mean, you could create a great, you know, sort of anti-film festival of horrible adaptations of children's books. I mean, poor Dr. Seuss, you know, there was the Grinch, and I mean, there was, you know, the great cartoon that Chuck Jones did, who was actually, you know, a friend of Dr. Seuss's in the 60s. But yeah, the more recent one, or the recent Cat in the Hat, there's a pretty mediocre animated version of Charlotte's Web from I think the 70s. Yeah, I mean, no, I think I agree. I think that's sad when that's all people know. I mean, this happened in my family a little bit. I don't mind the early Disney cartoon versions of Pooh. I kind of like. I mean, I think on their own terms they're fine, but I think it's you know, sad that that's all a lot of kids know. And there's also a lot of, you know, there's a lot of junky kind of, you know, spin-off books on those Disney cartoons, and some of the later ones I think get sort of silly. I tried to read the original. My kids loved all that stuff, and they had these different, you know, like, you know, Pooh and his forest friends or what, you know, but based on the Disney books. But yeah, when I tried to read them the real A.A. Milne books, they just didn't care for them. And I think that's a great example where, Yeah, probably. I would bet 90% of American children really only know Winnie the Pooh through Disney.
Lots of people are down on Disney for its interpretations of classic fairy tales, which is to say he bowdlerized them a lot. But, you know, you looked at the originals, the Grimm's fairy tales, and a lot of them really are too terrifying for little kids in their original form.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. There's killing and chopping. I mean, there's an amazing one that I would, you know, be fascinating to see Disney try to adapt. It would never work. It'd probably be more David Lynch, where, you know, the evil stepmother actually like kills the stepson and then turns him into a stew and feeds him to his father. I mean, it feeds him to his father. I mean, as one critic said, you just can't believe what you're reading. But yeah, I think some of the early, you know, when you take Snow White, I mean, one thing I think people don't give Disney credit for, I mean, a lot of these fairy tales are really very short too. There's not that much incident in them. I mean, if you look at, you know, Snow White, I don't have it in front of me, but you know, the Grimm version might be only 4 or 5 pages or something, or some of these other ones, or Cinderella, and you know, and here you are, you're Walt Disney, and you have to turn this into like an 80 or 90 minute movie. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to do, you know, you're going to have to add something. I mean, Snow White is, I think, a brilliant film. And, you know, one thing he does, I mean, if you look at in the original Grimm, the seven dwarves, they're not named. They're just, they have no personality. They're just these seven dwarves that she lives with. And then they're sad when she, you know, eats the poisoned apple. And, you know, they totally invented this great, you know, this amazing comedy troupe of, you know, Dopey and Sleepy and Doc and Bashful, et cetera, et cetera. And just really, you know, brought the story to life. Maurice Sendak was a big Disney fan. He writes, he was a wonderful children's book critic too, and actually writes very passionately about the film of Pinocchio, which he thinks was a big improvement on the original tale.
Bruce Handy is my guest. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Hey, Llama Llama, red pajama. Reads a story with who? With his mama. Hey, mama kisses. What? Baby hair. Mama llama goes all the way downstairs. Hey, llama llama. What? Red pajama. Feels alone with who? Without his mama. Hey.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was the rapper Ludacris reinterpreting the popular children's book Llama Llama Red Pajama. My guest this hour is Vanity Fair contributing editor Bruce Handy, author of Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. And I think that Ludacris rap works, Bruce.
I thought it was wonderful. I hadn't heard that before. Is that did he do a whole album of kids' books? I think it's wonderful.
It was on a radio show in L.A. called The Cruise Show, and I don't know if it's part of a larger project or not, but when I heard it, I loved it this morning.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, to me, like a lot of the great, you know, kids' books, especially the ones that rhyme that one, you know, they really are incredibly musical. I mean, that was a lot of the pleasure of, you know, reading these things aloud. I mean, they're you know, like sort of old poetry. They're meant to be read out loud. For me, the one that I never got tired of reading was Green Eggs and Ham, you mm-hmm. know, going back to Dr. Seuss. But just the rhythms of that, I just always found, you know, compelling. And like we were saying, too, you can read it different ways. You can find different emphases. I'd love to hear Ludacris do Green Eggs and Ham. If he's out there, Ludacris, if you're out there, please do Green Eggs and Ham. I would love that.
All right, we'll let you know if we hear back.
Yeah.
You believe that Ramona Quimby deserves a place in the American canon next to Tom Sawyer. What did Beverly Cleary understand so well about being a kid?
Well, you know, she just really got, I don't think she was the first writer, but she was certainly an early writer who just really wrote stories about kids, kind of living kid lives. You know, one thing, her very first book, Henry Huggins, you know, it starts off talking about, you know, Henry was bored, nothing interesting ever happened to Henry, which is, you know, it's kind of a radical thing for a kid's book, I think, especially at that time. You know, usually it's, you know, it's like Treasure Island or even, you know, Tom Sawyer, which is kind of, you know, was meant to be, you know, somewhat realistic and somewhat based on you know, Mark Twain's own childhood. You know, they end up going on this big adventure to find a, you know, treasure that's hidden in the cave or, you know, to write a story just where, you know, the adventure is a boy, you know, trying to bring his dog home on a bus, as in the first chapter of Henry Huggins, was, you know, kind of radical. And what I love about Beverly Cleary, and this was one thing for me that I also really learned out of reading to my kids and partly led to this book, was, you know, kind of reading her books about Klickitat Street, you know, starting with Henry Huggins, and there's a series of books about Henry and his dog Ribsy you know, Ramona and Beezus, the two sisters, are their neighbors. And you know, in the early books, you know, Henry is friends with Ramona and with Beezus, the older sister. And Ramona is just this kind of, she's almost this.
She's a pest.
She's a pest, yeah. She's kind of like, you know, comic relief or something. Every once she does something nasty and, you know, Henry and his friends go, oh, my God, girls, you know, they're so whatever. Sorry to be, you know, gender stereotyping again. But, yeah, but as they go along, Ramona starts, you know, taking more and more prominence, and you can almost feel as you read these books that she's kind of taking hold of Beverly Cleary's imagination. And then by the time you get to Ramona the Pest, which to me is really her Beverly Cleary's masterwork. You know, it's just she's just created such a vivid character, and she's so, I mean, in the way that Margaret Wise Brown, as we were talking about earlier, I think was so good at sort of empathizing with the point of view of a you know, an infant, really. You know, Beverly Cleary is so good at getting into the mindset of a kindergarten girl. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of the drama is about, you know, kind of dealing with the social aspects of kindergarten and how to, you know, Ramona has to learn how to kind of behave in a group, which, you know, of course, that's partly what kindergarten is about. You know, just in general, but she does such a good job of getting into Ramona's head. I mean, it's really, in some ways, a psychological novel. I think I compare it maybe a little, you know, maybe this was, you know, maybe I was going out on a limb a little bit, but I think in the book I compare it to, you know, Portrait of a Lady, which is also about a, you know, a young woman sort of dealing with what's to her a kind of alien culture and trying to find her way through that. But I don't know. I think Ramona bears, I think she is really one of the great American characters. And then, yeah, all the subsequent books where Cleary just completely focuses on her are just, they're all wonderful.
I think the genius of Cleary is that she recognizes so many of the things you get in trouble for as a small child are not actually rooted in some desire to misbehave. Either you don't quite understand what's expected of you, or you can only focus on the thing that's right in front of you and you lose your temper, and that's Ramona.
Exactly. Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, it's like, yeah, and it's, yeah, in some ways, it's, you know, it's a failure of adults to sort of properly explain what they want. Or again, yeah, it's that temptation. I love the part in Ramona the Pest where, you know, she kind of gets in trouble for school. She has her bossy sort of frenemy, Susan with long curls, right. And Ramona likes to pull them and go boing. And the teacher says, you can't do that. And, you know, Ramona does it again. And then the teacher says, well, you know, if you can't stop that, you have to, you know, you're going to have to go home today. And Ramona thinks really hard and realizes that she can't stop it. It's too fun, you know. But that's the kind of thing. That's really the kind of thing a kid would do. And then I love that she's honest about it, you know, in the way kids are very honest. And she says, "I can't do it. I better go home." It's a really an amazing sequence.
All right, let's jump back to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Rick is calling from Dallas. Hi, Rick.
Yes. Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Well, you know, this is kind of a sensational story about the Giving Tree, and what makes me think that this is true is because the guy that said it is a prolific author in his own right, died, oh, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, and was childhood friends of Shel Silverstein, a guy by the name of Brennan Manning. Mm-hmm. And the story goes, and he told this publicly, so I would think lawsuits would follow if this is not true, but he said publicly that he ran into Shel later in life, and they reconnected, and evidently Shel Silverstein, and this may explain some of the heaviness maybe that your guest mentioned, but he evidently, Shel had converted as a Jew, converted to Christianity, and the Giving Tree was his answer to the profoundness of that.
It's an interesting story. Have you heard that before, Bruce?
I hadn't heard that. That's that is interesting. Yeah, it certainly makes sense. I mean, I guess you could certainly, yeah, I mean, you could certainly, I think, read it as a Christian allegory. I mean, that I don't know if it's true, but it certainly seems like that would be a reasonable way to read the book, I think. You know, it's interesting. I mean, when a very moving experience for me was reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know, C.S. Lewis's book, which is definitely a Christian allegory. And, you know, when I first was read it as a little kid, I that completely went over my head. And then I read it again in high school, and I felt, oh, this is, you know, it felt like it was just, you know, it felt sort of heavy-handed, and oh, this is this big message book and whatnot, and I kind of turned my back on it. But then when I read it again, you know, for this book, I was very moved by the way Lewis portrays, you know, at the character of Aslan, who's kind of the stand-in for Christ, and he portrays him in a very I think moving way. And whether you find it, you know, whether you're a Christian or not, or whether you find it, you know, compelling as kind of theology, I think it's very compelling as an expression of what this religion and belief means to the author. I find it very moving in that way. I want to pursue that story about Shel Silverstein. It's an interesting one.
All right, let's jump back to the phones. Bill is on the line in Mansfield. Hi, Bill.
Hello. You got me crying like a baby, Chris. I have the memories that keep flooding back.
Hmm.
I have read all the genres and many of the classics, but on my top 10 list, there are 3 children's books.
What are they?
Love You Forever, Miss Spider's Tea Party, and my favorite is And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street.
You know those books, Bruce?
Oh yeah, Miss Spider's Tea Party a little bit. What was the first one? I'm not sure. I
Love You Forever, and I think, Bill, is that the one where you have the parent sort of watching the child at different stages in the child's development?
Yes.
Watching the child sleeping, and then at the very end, we're gonna spoiler alert. At the very end, people either love this or hate it. The quite aged mother. Is the person that the son goes to visit when she's old and I guess in a sick bed.
Oh wow, I have a feeling if I was reading that I would probably be crying too. I mean, that sounds very, very moving. I love to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street. That to me is really interesting in terms of Seuss's biography. You know what we were talking about at the end of The Cat in the Hat, where are the kids going to tell their mother or not? About the cat. I think it's sort of fascinating because in some ways it's the opposite ending of To Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, where the boy Marco, you know, has invented this fantastical tale of this insane parade that he's seen, and then at the very end his father says, "So what did you see today?" And he goes, "Nothing, just a cart and a horse," you know, which is kind of the point he started from. So I love that Dr. Seuss eventually decided, no, you know, let's give free rein to all this this stuff. You know, we're not going to. We're not going to, knuckle under to possibly disapproving parents in that way.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So when I was about 9 or 10, I read this book called The Girl Who Owned a City, and I loved it. It's this post-apocalyptic tale of a world where everybody over age 12 dies, and this 10-year-old girl kind of is really good at survival, and she figures out how to break into a grocery warehouse. I was so excited to find a copy to read my own kids, and then I realized it's this kind of angry, Ayn Randian sort of take care of yourself, and if you're lazy, tough. It didn't feel right to read to my very small children at all, but I didn't get that at all. That's when I read it as a kid.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I had a similar experience with A Wrinkle in Time, which I loved as a kid, and that also feels, it has, you know, reading it again, it felt like it had a very kind of, you know, stern kind of, you know, anti-communism, you know, felt very sort of steeped in sort of Cold War politics and stuff, which kind of turned me off of it. That sounds like a fascinating book. I mean, it's so fascinating the way kids are so interested in apocalyptic stuff. Like, you know, I remember that, you know, my kids, when they were reading all the Hunger Games books, and I was thinking, oh, this stuff is so, you know, I don't know if I really approve, you know, this is seems so
kind of violent for kids
to be reading. But then, I remember some of the stuff I read. Like, I certainly loved, you know, I loved, I remember reading, you know, 1984 at a pretty young age and some pretty bleak stuff, and you know, loving movies like The Omega Man, you know, where like Charlton Heston is like the last man on Earth fighting zombies and things like that. So I don't know, there's some, maybe this should be my next book. Like, why do kids love, you know, what is the appeal of apocalyptic fiction to kids? That book sounds really, I should check that out, the one that, The Girl Who Owned the City.
The Girl Who Owned a City, yeah. And I think we finally found a digital copy, so I think it is on Kindle, so you can check it out. And I'd love to know what you think about it when you read it, but I once loved it and no longer do.
It's a great title.
Yeah, yeah. It's still a compelling story, even if the moral is a little screwy. So, Bruce, not everybody has kids in their lives that would give them an excuse to reread these books. Do you think we should just go ahead and enjoy them, engage or re-engage just for the fun of it?
Well, I think so. I mean, to be honest, that's kind of partly why I wrote the book. I mean, I started writing children's book reviews for the New York Times Book Review. It kind of came about when my kids were too old to be read to, and I was sort of complaining to an editor there that I missed, you know, keeping up with new picture books, and I felt like I was losing touch with this thing that I had rediscovered, and he said, oh, you know, you should start reviewing picture books for us. So I did, and so I think in a way this is, you know, this whole process of reading and writing for me has just been doing sort of, you know, exactly that. I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody to, you know, to turn your back on adult literature or anything, but I think it's, you know, I think it's worth, you know, picking up. Anybody out there who hasn't read, you know, Charlotte's Web or Little House on the Prairie or, you know, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, whatever, you know, pick up an old favorite and see what you think of it now. I think you'll have an interesting experience.
Bruce Handy is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of a new book called Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult. Bruce, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Alan Roberts is technical director today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.